everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our ongoing series, part two of Saving the Planet, Saving Ourselves. Today, we're going to discuss the Anthropocene Age. Climate scientists and environmental activists refer to our postmodern era as the Anthropocene Age whenever they critique Western civilization's impact upon the changing climate and the planet's future ecological shifts and transformations. Indeed, modern industry and technology is destroying the planet unwittingly. Its carbon footprint is evidenced everywhere we look, but it's become so pervasive that it goes largely unnoticed. The food on our dining table has a history of greenhouse gas release, yet we're unaware of it. In fact, last evening, I was asked to watch a show. It was on one of the food channels. And as I turned it on to see what my friend said was so interesting, it was about a man who was challenging a big meal. A gigantic sandwich that had pounds of meat and cheese and eggs on it. It would have been, even for a normal American eater, about a 2-week supply of protein in one single sandwich, probably upwards of 4,000 or 5,000 calories, and none of it healthy. So we're not even at a point in our society at this moment where 90% of the American population thinks about, is the food I'm about to eat going to produce something constructive, health, will revitalize any of my systems, my lungs, my liver, kidneys, prostate, my brain, heart, my eyes, or will it in any way cause inflammatory conditions that could lead to diabetes or glaucoma or prostate cancer, breast cancer, uterine cancer, or muscle fatigue? Will it speed up the aging of my telomeres, the proteins on the end caps of chromosomes that when they shorten, your life shortens. When they lengthen, your life lengthens. If we had the ability, with every choice we made, just with food alone and beverages, that in front of us was a monitor, and it would tell us exactly how many minutes that particular choice would add to or take away from our lifespan, would we make a change? It is debatable that the average person would want to know and would simply disconnect the clock. It's as if we're living a very bizarre notion of our own lives. We're in such denial of the consequences of cause and effect. So on the one hand, the media gives us more than enough advantage when it comes to making bad choice. It is heavily promoted. And as a result, the very show that that person was on last night, eating a humongous portion of food, and he is not the first. Before him was the Man and Food show for years, that a man would eat 6 pounds of a given item at a given meal, always being championed and applauded and rooted on by an audience that would be packing into a restaurant. And that generally was the most popular restaurant many times in that entire city. Why? Because the food was healthy, because it was proper portion size, because the food was functional food, like broccoli with sulforaphane and indole-3 carbinol, and sprouts and juices, beet juice to increase nitric oxide in your blood and increase your circulation and help your heart? No. Instead, we dismiss programs that promote prevention, and we focus upon those programs and those individuals that promote drama, emotional violence or physical violence, and unhealthy choices. And then we glamorize it to the point where people want to go and eat at that restaurant. Whether they're diabetic or obese is irrelevant. They have seen something that they want to participate in. Now, if they're not even at a point where they will make any form of prudent choice, is this food good for me? Will it help me with my weight and my blood sugar, my blood pressure? And that's not even in their thought process. It's salty and crunchy or sweet and soft, and they want it. And they want it now. And they want as much as they can gorge. Well, then why would we expect those same people to be conscious enough and proactive enough to even suggest to themselves, let alone others, that that food, the animal proteins, the dairy in the cheese, and the chickens for the eggs, and the bacon from the pork, that that is also contributing to global warming? And when they live in California and are sustaining the worst fire in California history at this very moment, with more than 1 million acres consuming the landscape, where there is no safe, sustainable place to live in California or in many other places, and there is no guarantee that Florida will not be uninhabitable because of the chronic dry brush fires caused by the chronic dryness in the spring and the torrential rain from hurricanes in the fall. Now, we just had 7 million people evacuate the state, and that meant millions were left there. And right now, as one of the people who was in that hurricane and am living with the consequences, I can't even get a fence person, a lanai person, a water person to come to the property, let alone a contractor to fix roofs or take out drywall that is molded, because they say there is a year wait before they even come to give an estimate. Because it wasn't just a small community or a town, it was the entire state with tens of millions of people who were adversely affected with a Category 4 with winds of over 150 miles an hour, and that's just the beginning. 2 or 3 or 4 years from now, that'll seem like a minor hurricane. And the fire in California, it'll be perpetual. It'll be 12 months a year, every single day of the year, 24/7, somewhere in California, there'll be fire. And that's not even mentioning volcanoes that could erupt, which are erupting around the world, including in Mexico, and earthquakes that have devastated other countries, luckily not ours, yet. But we do have dust storms, we have sandstorms, and we have global warming, and we have torrential rain, 20 trillion gallons of rain dropped on Houston with that storm. That was a Category 2. How many gallons will drop when there's a Category 4 or 5? And what will happen when, not if, when a Category 5 hits New York? Imagine the $1 trillion damage, the lives lost, and imagine all of Long Island no longer capable of being rebuilt or sustaining safety and quality of life for its residents and the Jersey Shore. That's what we're looking at. That's not even the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario is when the temperature goes to 2 degrees increase Celsius, and then it becomes so rapid that we'll go to 3 and 4 degrees shortly thereafter, and we won't be able to grow food in much of the United States or the rest of the world for that matter. So how likely is it for an individual to want to know about the environment and hence stay intentionally ignorant if they're not even willing to do something as immediate and personal and intimate as to protect their eyes and heart and brain? And that's why when people say our government will fix it, technology will fix it, we'll do a Marshall Plan for putting up flood walls, and no, we won't. Not now, not ever. We can't. Why not? Because our body politic has been so corrupted. It doesn't matter whether you're blaming the Republicans or the Democrats, the business community or the scientific community. They're all equally guilty. Because as long as the people in power do not want to fundamentally change and reduce their margins of profit, workers won't be given any percentage of the profits that the shareholders in the investor class are reaping to the tune of trillions of dollars collectively, while the average person has to frequently work 2 jobs. So you see, our very capitalist system is intimately tied with global warming and acidification of the oceans and dead zones in the oceans and the drought in California and the drought in Florida and the drought in Georgia and the drought in Kansas, Illinois, Montana, and the flooding in those same states. So if we're not able to look at the pieces, let alone even want to know what are the pieces, there's 80 pieces, there are 40 tipping points, what are these? Which ones could we impact? Which ones can't we impact? Where should I live? At what point should I begin to make a move away from where I'm at to another place? We don't even have the conscious awareness, the mindfulness to realize that we're playing Russian roulette. And that chamber is going to have that bullet in it sooner rather than later. Now, I've had the good fortune to spend the last 10 years working nearly full-time along with others, including our resident scholar, Richard Gale. Thousands, tens of thousands of hours together we have spent reading scientific journals by the thousands, and books on the subject, and interviewing the best minds we could find. Now, there's two ways of doing it. You interview the scientist who is connected with industry or is funded by industry at a university who will tell you, yes, there is a problem, but it's not man-made. Now, these are the same scientists the tobacco industry would have used to deny the harm or addictive quality of cigarettes for decades. These are the same scientists who would tell you that we need more research. We don't have enough. These are the people who are meant to obfuscate, to deny, to avoid, to spin, using their pedigrees from Harvard and Yale and other prestigious schools and bodies of higher education, and think tanks, dozens and dozens of think tanks, specifically with a mandate, keep the public disarmed with information. Don't allow them to have any strong views, and those who do, discredit them, destroy them, marginalize them, put them on Wikipedia so they can't make any changes by a system that is so corrupt that no matter what they say about you, you can't correct it. Or do something else. Troll them until they finally give up and say it's not worth the attacks to protect the public. If the public's not willing to protect itself and be aware of its problems, why should I sacrifice my comfort, my life, my quality of thought, when they don't give a damn about anything except their own selfish and obsessive day-to-day lives? They could care less. Now, that's a cynic that would say that. The optimist would say, hold on a second, there's still 4 or 5% of the American population that are very conscious from all generations. The largest single group becoming vegan and going to a plant-based diet are the younger people, people in their teens and 20s and 30s, and some older people who have finally awakened, maybe due to a heart attack or a stroke or obesity, and realized, yes, I have to make changes. I may not like to, but I'm going to. That's what we're contending with. We do have positive movements. We have a growing vegan movement. We have a growing environmental movement. So both sides can argue persuasively that yes, we will do something, or no, we won't, and here's why. But one thing that cannot be denied, that every time we make a choice today, there will be a consequence. And the fact that right today, in this hour, we're not submerged in lava, or we're not looking at how to outrun an earthquake, or we're not drenched in a tidal wave, does not mean that somewhere else in the world they are not facing that, and in time, we also will. We're like the frog that got too comfortable when the water was warm and now it's boiling. That's the reality. And so this is persuasive, and that's why it goes unnoticed, unreported on. So again, let me state, the food on our dining table has a history of greenhouse gas release. But so too does our mobile phone, our computer, our jeans, our sneakers, everything we use. And aside from extreme weather events, we often fail to notice the immediacy and rate of these changes, such as the arrival of certain predatory beetles invading trees on our lawns, and the arrival of a plant species in our neighborhood park that should only thrive in a different climate, or the arrival of new blights decimating forests. Not long ago, I took my annual little spiritual retreat. I go away for about 10 days alone, and I find a quiet place, and I fast. I just have water, no creature comforts, just out in nature, and I commune with nature. And a recent one was out in Arizona, going up to the high end of Arizona and past Phoenix, which is hot and dry as a bone, and going up through the beauty of Sedona. You can drive through it in 5 minutes, the beautiful red rock formations and the artistic community, and going up the Flagstaff where the university is. And then outside of Flagstaff is the beautiful high mountains. And when you're standing in the forest where you can see for 20 miles, and it's generally the air is pristine, but this time, no. Smoke and fire everywhere. And as I spoke with one of the locals, I asked them, how often is this happening? They said, now it's happening all the time. And the air is polluted, the forests are burning, the trees are dying because of beetle infestation. This is where the people in the hot climate of Phoenix would come in the summertime to cool down. Their second homes were up here. Not now. Because now it's hot everywhere. And with that comes no longer a controlled environment. There was a 5-year University of Delaware study predicted that 92% of southern states' needle-green evergreen trees will disappear in the near future due to the southern pine beetle. Now, the insect is a native to Central America. However, in 1990, milder winters have enabled the pest to migrate as far north as New Jersey and more recently onto Long Island. And massive tree die-offs are occurring throughout North America and other continents. And when Los Alamos National Laboratory, along with scientists from 18 other institutions and federal agencies, ran multiple global warming simulations to check and cross-check their results, the conclusions remain the same. Climate change was the machine driving massive tree and forest die-offs. This includes the Great Boreal Forest, reaching around the planet's northernmost climate and one of the most important and last natural resources that assures we have oxygenated air to breathe. Already, it is being decimated, and human intelligence and ingenuity to override the forces of nature are not up to the fight. And regardless of how critical or even desperate a situation becomes, there dangles before us the faux promise that we can find the technology to solve it. But humanity is not a savior for the simple fact the earth does not need saving, except from our own limited, awry perception and destructive actions. Global warming, writes Roy Scranton, author of Learning to Die in the Anthropocene, he says, is what is called a wicked problem. It doesn't offer any clear solutions, only better or worse responses. Well, regardless of the billions of tons of carbon dioxide and methane and other greenhouse gases our culture pumps into the atmosphere, and regardless of how acidic we turn the oceans, the Earth will tweak and retweak itself in order to return to a homeostatic state. But it'll be without the numerous species now faced with extinction. It will continue to self-organize and reestablish stability. It may require thousands of years after the Anthropocene has passed before she finds a balance and bursts anew, albeit without any of us, or for that matter, the presence of countless other creatures and beings extinguished by climate change. This was the overriding theme of Alan Weisman's best-selling thought experiment, The World Without Us, later made into a PBS special, which portrayed the planet coming alive again after humanity destroyed itself. Earth will heal nicely, thank you, without our technological intervention, without Al Gore, and the hubris of the superiority complex unique to our species. There are certain dominant characteristics that define psychopathic behavior. One is the inability to feel remorse over destructive behavior or the committing a crime that inflicts terrible suffering upon another. Another common psychopathic trait is to regard violent acts as permissible and perhaps even beneficial. Therefore, we destroy and kill thousands of species, live off a diet responsible for the butchering of billions of animals, and mow over ecosystems for mining and development, or to raise livestock and sow genetically engineered crops, survey and drill some more for the Earth's last drops of fossil fuels, all in the name of capitalist growth and expansion, at the expense of our health and wellness, all because corporations and the global elite, the captains of industry and our governments, international banks, our educational institutions, and the corporate media whitewash these ecological systems as being virtuous and necessary in order for us to enjoy. And they're wrong completely. On the U.S. Pacific coast, a jelly-like creature has migrated from its native warmer tropical waters off the Central American coast as far north as the Gulf of Alaska. This creature is a part of an invasive species, as are many other organisms that are multiplying with increasing global temperatures. These zoids are now so plentiful that the fish population are threatened. They interfere with the fishing industry and fisheries, and as a consequence, the proliferation of these zoids has a direct adverse impact on communities and economies. In her book, Stung, on Jellyfish Blooms and the Future of the Ocean, Arthur Lisa Ann Gershwin writes, "We are creating a world more like the late Precambrian than the late 1800s, a world where jellyfish ruled the seas and organisms with shells did not exist. We are creating a world where we humans may soon be unable to survive or want to." Gershwin further explains how the increase in jellyfish contributes to global warming. On the one hand, jellyfish consume enormous quantities of diatoms and other plankton, which help sequester carbon dioxide and expel oxygen. Second, jellyfish excrete carbon-rich waste taken up by the ocean bacteria. As the number of bacteria increases in parallel to blooming jellyfish populations, they are converted to miniature factories pumping out carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and further acidifying the ocean's waters. Or if you go to a market, would you notice that fish, including tuna and cod, are getting smaller? Fish, too, are directly affected by global warming. This was the conclusion of scientists at the Institute for Ocean and Fisheries at the University of British Columbia, based upon empirical data. Warmer oceans means less oxygen to sustain fisheries' bodies function because fish are constrained by their gills in the amount of oxygen they can extract from water. The study estimates that 3.4 million metric tons of fish will be lost for each degree Celsius of atmospheric warming. That's a huge amount of fish. These several short stories reveal adverse effects happening at this very moment in the U.S. alone due to global warming. They are among many thousands of others occurring across the globe. When we speak about climate change, the boundaries that divide national interests become irrelevant. Why? Because climate change and the heating planet is a global crisis of our own making, and very little is being done at either the political, domestic, or international levels. It's certainly not being done at the personal level to abate the sources and causes of this emergency. And because as the population of India and Brazil and China and South Korea are increasing, and especially the upper middle class, the educated class, the professional class, what do you think they want? They want what we Americans have had for a long time, what our working class, our middle class, our professional class, our lawyers, doctors, engineers, and their children. And that class alone represents 17 million people. That does not include the millionaire class that has $1 million, not even including their property. And you put their families together, that's 100 million Americans living, most of them, with no concern about what they produce, what impact it has upon other people, or the planet. So when other people become a part of that successful and stable working class and middle class in India, in China, you're looking at numbers that are just staggering. Right now, India alone has about nearly 3 billion people, as does China. Together, it's 2.5 to 2.6 billion people. We only have about 330 million. So imagine they have a more thriving and educated middle class than we do, by far. They want hamburgers and hot dogs, and they want shrimp. They don't care if it's factory farm. They want tilapia. They don't care how it's grown in cesspools. No, they want what we want. They want cars. And they want all the conveniences of a new type of lifestyle. And the younger people, they may not want all the material possessions, but they're big on junk food, and they're really big on the latest technology. They don't ask, did my computer have to have special parts where the raw materials came from exploiting people in Africa to get that cobalt or to get that nickel or to get that zinc or to get that chromium? They don't care. So if they don't care about how something is made and where it comes from and its progenitor, where the original sources were, why would you think they would care about the environment? Look at China. It is a contradiction in terms. It is a duality that is mind-numbing. They have more polluted rivers than any place else in the world. Second would be India. They have half of all their rivers are so polluted they can't even use the water from those rivers for irrigation. On top of that, they can't produce enough food for their own citizens, so they're gaining large tracts of land in Africa and other countries in South America to exploit them. They don't have enough hardwood, so they go in and buy up the hardwood in one of the last remaining hardwood forests in Peru because they want hardwood furniture, just like Americans do. They no longer want cheap particle board. So you see, what we have created for the world, a consumer-based society, everyone is following. The scientists, the doctors, the politicians, the capitalists in each one of these economies, well, do you think they're going to restrain from a lifestyle and consumer purchasing to show their desire to do something positive about people's health and the environment? That's not going to happen. And before the orgy of fossil fuel exploitation and consumption switched into hyperdrive around 1950, there were 90% more fish in our oceans. That's 90% that we've lost since 1950. There was 40% more phytoplankton, one of the most important manufacturers of our planet's oxygen and an essential organism necessary to counter acidity caused by human waste and pollution. In less than 70 years, humans have already removed twice the number of trees still standing in the world's forests and jungles. Do you think for one second that any of the governments or the scientists in mass would say, we should not do any more exploitation of the boreal forest? We need them. Them and the rainforest are the lungs of the planet. We need it. No. If it's profitable, exploit it. If it's a finite resource, then find another finite resource somewhere else. Corrupt the politicians or pay off people, but get the resources to feed this whole concept that the only successful kind of society is one that is constantly growing, 1, 3, 10, 12% a year. But at what cost? We would have to have two full planets to supply us with what we're doing at this moment. and not even a discussion about proper and ethical birth control through education by explaining to people how much of the resources it takes for a baby just in its first 6 years of life. We just don't care. And as I said this many times, the reason why nothing will change, not with our health, not with our environment, certainly not with our diet, is because we're not in enough pain yet. We're far from being in that kind of pain. We will have to go almost up to the apocalypse before we finally say, I give up. I'm going to do the right thing. We're seemingly incapable, as a society, individuals accepted, of doing the right thing about anything. Look at how we vote for presidents. Unless you go back to Eisenhower before him, FDR, look at the people we vote for. Will they look presidential? Yeah, that's why you want to vote for them? Or we need a woman, or we need a black, or we need someone else. And that's why you're voting for them? Identity politics instead of who is best to serve all the needs of the people and the planet? And how far we've come from reason and common sense and spiritual values. So don't be optimistic, because we're not all going to make it into that boat. Not everyone's going to be saved from themselves. But that's what we're looking at. In point of fact, right now there would be 3 times more fresh water if we were conscious. There would be over 30% less greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. What is equally important to run through our mind's imagination is the gloomy scenario that during this same 70-year period, as the resources to sustain human life dwindle, our population steadily increases. Since 1950, 2.5 billion people, that's it. And it will nearly triple in the next 2 years from what it was in 1950. It was 2.5 billion, and it's going up to probably close to 8 billion. The simple math is clear that humanity is headed towards extremely dark and frightening times in the very near future. Now, what do I believe? It's not important what I believe. I can only give you my insight as a scientist, as an environmentalist, as the author of Clearer, Cleaner, Safer, Greener, that was part of what launched the whole concept of food, earth, consciousness back in the decades ago at the first Earth Day. And being an organic farmer, teaching farms in upstate New York, Fertler Farm, and in Texas at the Healing Springs Ranch, and still today doing the same, but also trying to understand the human condition, why so many people refuse to make the right choices for themselves and society, and why we've only had a minority who've been empowered to make those right choices. So what I see is merely my own guesstimate, and I hope that I'm completely wrong. But I will offer this subjective projection. I believe that within the next 5 years, we will have a triple collapse, the perfect storm. I believe that the dollar will be completely collapsed from where it is now as the world's leading reserve currency, with a few other currencies far behind, like the euro and the yuan. And I believe that it'll be replaced by the ruble and mixed currencies in the yuan, because theirs will be backed by gold. They're buying or manufacturing up to almost 30 tons of gold per year. That's a huge amount of gold. And they've been doing it for decades. We, on the other hand, have no gold. We have nothing backing up our currency. And now China, with cooperation from the Southeast Asian countries, will begin this year or next, will surpass the United States as the number one economy in the world. And they are building the longest and most complex and expensive transportation infrastructure, the New Silk Road. It's over 2,700 miles. They're building dozens of ports and superhighways and high-speed trains. We're not building any of that. and they're working in cooperation with countries. Now, it benefits them, and they're giving a lot of money, trillions of dollars, in this project. And as a result, they're having a place of employment for millions of Chinese in these other countries, working in cooperation with these countries. Ask the average American, what is China doing in Iran? And why is Iran central to this whole aspect? They're clueless. And so when you look what other countries are doing and how much they spend on infrastructure and sustainable efforts, Russia, under Putin now, irrespective of what you may think of him and the kleptocracy that is common in Russian politics that he has also participated in, he is now going all organic, no GMOs. And within the next 2 to 3 years, Russia will be the largest country in the world producing the most organic produce in the world. We, on the other hand, won't have any organic produce that's real organic based upon supporting through the DART Act genetic engineering and doing all we can to destroy small farmers, not helping them, and only supporting the massive monocrop industrial farms. Other small farms are, and intentional farming communities are blossoming all over the world, and we can't get one started in the United States. We have over 1 million women farmers in the United States. Can you name me one? And guess where many of them are? Arizona. And why? When it is one of the worst states in the United States to live in, for a lot of reasons, not the least of which it doesn't have good topsoil. You could have a 160-acre farm, and I'll bet that all but 1 acre is just desert, where you got creosote trees and scrub brushes and bits and pieces of wild grass for sheep or goats. But outside of that, you're limited in water, you're running out of water, and it's a lot of work to run a farm. So why aren't they moving en masse to sustainable environments? Why aren't they stopping trying to farm in deserts and do hydroponics and aquaponics and the new state-of-the-art, which is jumping so fast now in new technologies that by the time you buy a hydroponic set, there's something to take its place that's better, more efficient, gives you a higher crop and a faster yield, all organic. So it's not about just wanting to do something. It's about being in the right place at the right time with the right idea and the right support system and being the right person, none of which is going on with 95% of all these women farmers. But no one even talks about this, yet we should. People aren't even aware of Vandana Shiva's magnificent organic farm at the base of the Himalayas. We filmed there. So we have a lot of research to do to become aware of what our potential is. So I believe that because we, as a society, are not only refusing to change, but we've doubled down in being either conservative and Republican or liberal and Democrat, both of which are completely controlled by the oligarchical deep states class, and that the real liberals and the real conservatives who took their traditional values, actually which are very compatible, and they dropped out of that and became independents, but there's no organization among those independents. When there is, there'll be a force to be reckoned with. That's where your change is going to come from. Combining the best of the baby boomers who are finally awakening up out of this Me Too stupor they've been in, breeding the most selfish and self-obsessed and disconnected from reality generations in history, and the younger people who realize, wow, am I lucky to have had the upbringing and discipline and focus upon morals, manners, and valuing the critical thinking skills that my parents told me about that I may have rebelled against, but now I see why they did the right thing. And when you take the best of the millennials and the best of the X generation and the best of the Y generation and the best of the baby boomers, then you have something. The senior citizens lost and forgotten, and they're not coming back. Unfortunately, and I'm sad to say that, because I'd hoped through my whole career there would be a renaissance of senior citizens gathering together, where they did, in gated communities to play golf on a grass that has more pesticides in it than any commercial farm, and in effect shunt themselves away from the responsibilities of the rest of the world. There's been no demonstrations. There's been no mass protest. There's been nothing from the senior citizens except looking at a commercial that visualizes them as being nothing but helpless and needing diapers and ointment creams or erectile dysfunction medication or something for their dementia. They have been betrayed, and many of them believe that there's nothing there but a long, slippery slope out of life, and spend what they can on how to diminish the symptoms, but never look any further. Not once have they been given the idea that they can be rejuvenated, that they can reverse all this, they can get out of these gated communities and regain a sense of the real world. But think of this. At a recent Davos conference, one of the major topics was survival. And one of the big concerns is surviving from the public, the have and have nots. I can tell you that a lot of multimillionaires and billionaires are already buying their bunkers and buying their places where they can live with their family away from the unwashed masses that they fear for the very inequality that they may have been participating in. So I see it coming where you'll have 1,000 or more green zones, safety places, where if you're wealthy enough or successful enough or powerful enough, what's in that is a safe zone where you'll have the culture that we have come to appreciate. You'll have theaters and you'll have boutiques and restaurants and parks, and people will live and work. But to get in there to be one of the people working, you'll have to have some form of identification card or a chip that allows you in so you can be monitored, so you can't be a troublemaker, because if you do something, instantly you'll be found out because you'll have a chip. And so those people will be able to at least have what they consider a safe haven from gangs and from marauders and from the decay of a society that no longer has the money to pay for even basic infrastructure. The streets won't be fixed. The garbage won't be removed with any regularity. The roads and the grid will be decayed for the rest. So there'll be those in protected zones and everyone else is on your own. And just imagine how that's going to work out. If you think people on a Black Friday are nuts and primordial and reptilian and will trample over someone to get something they don't need with money they don't have, imagine what will happen when there's not enough food. The food that does exist, and it'll be plentiful, they won't be able to afford. Already this year, there have been multiple food riots around the world where people have been stampeded to death because we don't pay attention to how many people are starving in Yemen today, over 12 million, and how many hundreds of thousands of children are adversely affected and are dying daily in one of the poorest, if not the poorest, country in the Middle East. And who's causing it? The United States, Great Britain, France, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Kuwait, and Bahrain, all ganging up on this small country. But we don't pay attention to it because it's not us. So I believe that when the dollar collapses, not completely, but substantially devalued, then people who have assets in the dollar are going to be wiped clean. I believe that the environment will also be the second part of this perfect storm, where we will have, even in those cities that are orange or green spaces and are safe, that you'll have devastating floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, drought, and restrictions in many places on water use. So that's going to really impede. Now, if you're rich enough, you can always get water. You can always be protected. You can be in a skyscraper. You can withstand a Category 5, as they did in Houston. You know, millions of people adversely affected. 200,000 homes flooded. Didn't touch one millionaire in those skyscrapers. They either could afford not to be there when this was going on, or they would have food. They were not out of water, and they didn't have to concern themselves with the contamination of over 1 million pounds of toxins leaching out of those refineries into the air, soil, and water. So even if they were in a contaminated zone, they were not contaminated. That's what wealth can do. It differentiates the circumstances of your existence. So, but if for everyone else, how can you live in a house that's got massive mold and you don't have flood insurance? You can't. And we still haven't rebuilt from Katrina. We haven't rebuilt from Sandy, which was only a Category 1. We haven't, and Katrina was only a Category 3 when it hit. It was 5 in the water, but not when it hit land. So imagine trying to survive a Category 4 or 5 if you're the average person and your insurance doesn't cover but about 10%. And right now, most people could reasonably expect only about 10 to 12% of the damage done in Florida, in Texas, in Louisiana, and Mississippi to be covered by your insurance. Insurance companies are in the business of denying claims. So, you've got the environment, you've got the destruction of our bubble economy, the equity of 25,000 points in Wall Street, that'll be collapsed down to what is more realistic, around 6 or 7. You'll have about $20 trillion of wealth wiped out. People's pensions will be wiped out. People who can live a comfortable, if not high-end lifestyle now, who can pay for their gated communities or pay for their condominiums. What's going to happen when your funds that were put in by the people overseeing, the trustees of your pensions, your fire department pensions, your school teachers' pensions, those are all being handled by people who are just interested in how much they can get on return of that investment, and you can get them wiped out. If you doubt me, look at what happened in Orange County, California, about a dozen or so years ago, where they lost almost all the value of their pensions. And then the third perfect storm, after the economy, and most of it, goes upside down, and people are struggling, and food is very expensive, and government subsidies are minimal, and infrastructure has been broken down. Now imagine personal health. Do you expect this generation that now is number one in the workforce, and with 10,000 baby boomers retiring every 24 hours, do you imagine this generation that has steeped in debt, student loan debt of over $1.3 trillion, car debt, and not able to repay it with compounding interest, and not trained in dealing with life issues or critical thinking? Exactly how are they going to be part of the solution? They won't be. Now imagine the health crisis. We're on a trajectory to have at least 75% of all people in the United States, including children, suffering from multiple diseases in the next 10 years. Right now, half of all Americans, actually more than half, are obese and overweight. And with that comes heart disease and cancers. So exactly how are we supposed to be optimistic when virtually all the major choices that we are making politically and through our institutions are against us? And then throw into the mix, if we have 1.5 million gang members now, imagine how many we're going to have when the economy goes south. And just as one example, the day after the hurricane, when I went out to the street, I heard a truck and I went out to see what was going on. It wasn't a truck helping people on the street or bring in water or electricians trying to set up the poles so people could have electricity. We didn't have electricity for 4 weeks or water. But these were people looking at who had left the state so they could steal their furniture. They came on the property. And I had no intention of allowing them to steal anything. And my conversation with them made that very clear. But think of all the people who are not there to protect their homes. Massive, unparalleled burglaries occurred in Florida. More than you could ever imagine. I watched how many trucks went up and down the street just going into people's property who weren't home. They had 7 million people, Floridians, that had evacuated the state. There was nothing protecting their home. So that's what I'm predicting is going to be happening, and it's going to start now. And it's only going to accelerate. So we will see the full impact of this within the next 3 years. So it's comforting to become complacent and simply consider the gradual decay and death of the planet's ecosystems as unusual or freak coincidences. Rarely do we give thought about the deeper causal factors that point directly back to our individual and societal behaviors. Winters start later, spring arrives earlier, prolonged rainfall and extreme weather incidents are perceived as mere abstractions of reality. As more months of excessive heat and drought occur, we say, wow, it's hot. Scientists are fond of saying this is the new normal, just as the mainstream media would have us believe that obesity and a shorter lifespan are new norms as well. That everyone should be overweight is normal. That everybody should be tied into reality television is normal. But life continues. We passively accept the adverse changes subtly affecting our lives. Assimilation and adaptation to inimical change is far easier and more comforting than waking up from our ignorance or denial of life-threatening problems. People simply say, well, that's a weird year. Or they'll say, weather's been very strange lately, and assume everything will return to a median range the following year. Everything is supposed to be cyclic, right? But the later years of normalcy don't reappear. Each year witnesses new record-breaking weather events somewhere in the world, and this is part of what the Anthropocene Age reflects. So what is meant when we say that humanity and all other species and the very planet itself have entered the Anthropocene Age? The Anthropocene means more than what humanity does today or has done in the past since the dawn of modern industrial society over 200 years ago when the steam engine was invented. The term is not descriptive solely of our present century, but refers to an entire age in geological time. The earlier Cenozoic era started 65 million years ago after the extinction of non-flying dinosaurs and the rapid appearance of mammals. And earlier geological ages also experienced catastrophic changes. The last and more recent Holocene era began at the end of the Ice Age approximately 11,700 years ago. But these changes were based upon natural geophysics and phenomena occurring within the planet's geological systems. Or they were accidental, such as the case of an asteroid roughly 6 miles in diameter smashing into the Earth's surface and overnight altering the atmosphere and global temperature, which gave rise to the Cenozoic era. The Anthropocene is also utterly unique in geological time. It is not only the geophysical rhythms altering the planet naturally that was the case for the previous epochs. During the past 200 years, a new agent of geological change has appeared, modern Homo sapiens, and the emergence of an industrialized civilization alienated from nature and its origins. And this agent has now become so pervasive and independent from its natural lifeline, so alienated from its natural home, which brought it forth, that like the Cenozoic asteroid, humanity has morphed into an alien power affecting and reshaping all geo and ecosystems that would otherwise keep the Earth in a natural state of equilibrium and balance. This is the era of Anthropos, the Greek word for human, but also appropriately the name of a social robot designed to mimic human behavior by Media Lab Europe. It is a new geological age of our own creation. Yes, in 1873, an Italian geologist named Antonio Stoppani observed that humans were increasing their influence upon the world, thereby adversely affecting the Earth's ecological systems. He proposed that the planet be entered through a new era in its geological history, which he called the Anthropocene era, the seventh geological age since the Earth formed in the solar system as a cluster of gas and dust 4.6 billion years ago, and the eighth epoch during the age of mammals, which began 65 million years ago. And during his lifetime, his insights and predictions failed to take hold in the sight of community, and Western civilization was still in the midst of the Enlightenment's euphoric high over the sudden burst of scientific discoveries and the powers of reason over instinct. And it was during this age of reason when Darwin's theories of human evolution took hold of the intellectual imagination and gradually merged with the utopian myths of infinite industrial and economic progress. And the myth has since solidified into the Western consciousness, creating a worldview that today perceives our species as the masters and gods of creation, the supreme rulers of its terrestrial destiny. But we are wrong. I'm Gary Nall, and on our next episode, we will continue examining our impact and what choices we have that could still make a difference. Thank you for listening.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see, oh, what's going on.